We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. There are people all over the globe who spend parts of their lives in online virtual worlds. Our guest, anthropologist Tom Belstorff, spent more than 2 years doing fieldwork in one of the largest of these worlds, Second Life. And what he was trying to do was apply the methods that anthropologists use to study other cultures. He was trying to apply those methods that are used in the quote-unquote real world to explore this new frontier of human life. And it's something that he has continued to be very interested in. He wrote a book about it that was first published 2 years ago, the title Coming of Age in Second Life. The book is published by the Princeton University Press and is now available in paperback. So the book is out there if you would like to read it. We talked about it, in fact, on this program in October 2008 when the book was new. And I'm pleased to be able to welcome here to the studio to have some more conversation on this subject. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll be talking about some of the issues raised by virtual people participating in virtual worlds. He'll be talking on the topic Placing the Virtual Body, Avatar Cora Seiferg. That's this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus. There are a number of sponsors. The main sponsor of his visit is the Department of Anthropology here at the University of Illinois. And this is an event in the MillerCom series. So anyone who is interested in hearing him should feel welcome to attend. It's free and open to the public. And he'll be giving his talk this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory on the campus. So you can stop by. And on this program, questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, people have questions, they can join in on the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. I went back and I listened to the interview that we did now 2 years ago. And as we were just kind of chatting, I guess my thought was that maybe at that point 2 years ago, the idea of something like Second Life might have seemed odd or strange or difficult for people to understand. And now in this age of Facebook and MySpace and so much social networking, I would think that more and more people at least would say, oh, yes, I get that. I know what that is, and I understand why people would want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think like with all technologies, these things are becoming more common or more easy for people to understand. And Farmville, I think, is still the number one application on Facebook, and that's a sort of basic, simple virtual world. And I forget the exact number, but I think it's 7 out of the 10 largest virtual worlds now are for children. Things like Club Penguin or Habbo Hotel, these things that have millions of people, young people, participating in them that most adults aren't even aware are happening. And so, you know, like happens with many technologies, as time passes, it becomes more familiar and gets embedded into all kinds of things.
I think you talked about how when you first started to get involved with Second Life and to study it, maybe there were thousands of people in it. I think by the time that the book went to print, they were maybe up to 1 million people. I don't know how many people are involved in this now.
Yeah, it's sort of plateaued. It's sort of a medium-sized virtual world. When I started, two ways that people sort of try and measure the size of these things is the number of accounts. But that can be tricky because sometimes it's like a Gmail or something where people can have a lot of free accounts. And then people will also look at what they call concurrency, how many people are there at once. So when I started, there were about 5,000 accounts, and the maximum number of people in Second Life at any one time was about 200. Now there's about 1.3 million active accounts, people who have logged in the last month or so. And the number of people in Second Life at any one time right now goes between about 30,000 to 70,000 people there at once. So that's not small by any means, but compared to World of Warcraft or Habbo Hotel, it's actually not that big. So it's sort of a medium-sized virtual world now in the sort of global situation that you have with virtual worlds.
Yeah. Now, people, I think, are probably used to the idea of fantasy, role-playing fantasy games, either things that they do with their computers or things that are online that may have multiple players, could be a lot of people all over the world. That idea, I think maybe some people get. But But this is a little bit different. And I think that in some ways, now as I think about it, maybe Facebook, MySpace, that is more of the model. It's more like that. That is, it's more of a place for social interaction, more like what people do in their daily lives, much more than the kind of other the kind of games that maybe people are used to.
Yeah, well, in the sort of ecology or whatever the right word is of these technologies, there are several sort of overlapping things, and it can be confusing to people because they share some characteristics and there's some things that are different. So the people who created Second Life were very interested in ideas of fantasy, and so they created it so that your name in Second Life isn't the same as your physical world name, although now there's sort of ways to get around that. They didn't have to have done that. You can have a virtual world where I would be Tom Belstorff. I'd be the same as, you know, as I am in the physical world. So there is sometimes that issue of role play, but not always in these virtual worlds. And then it is definitely can, for many people, be a space of socialization like Facebook. But the difference is that Facebook isn't a place in the sense where you're sort of co-present with people. It's a network. I mean, that's why the new movie is a social network. And so virtual worlds are places. Something like Facebook is a network. And there's interesting consequences to the differences between a place or a network. But now on Facebook, for instance, I don't know how much you use Facebook, but you can do live chat with your friends, and you can even do it with a group of people. And when you start to have that where you're in real time communicating with several people by text, that starts to look like a very early virtual world that used to be called a MUD, the text-only virtual worlds, because it starts to become a kind of shared place. Mm-hmm. Or if you go into Farmville or Yeovil or one of these very simple virtual worlds that exist within Facebook, that's also a kind of virtual world. So these technologies are overlapping and interpenetrating with each other in really interesting ways. And part of my job as a researcher is to try and pull those things apart and say, okay, what are some commonalities between these things, and then what are some differences too? Because they aren't all the same, but they aren't all completely separate either.
Yeah. Well, what's real? I think one of the interesting dimensions of this is that what you decided to do as an anthropologist was to look at this place as a place. As a place where people lived, as a place where people were making culture, and can I, as an anthropologist, do what anthropologists? A lot of anthropologists do go to another place and look at the people who live there and look at how they live and try to figure out how they see the world and what their life is like. And you said, well, why could I not go to this place and do that same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually right now working on a new book with three colleagues that we're trying to finish by next April that's going to be called A Handbook of Ethnographic Methods for Virtual Worlds, because this question of method has been interesting to so many people. You wouldn't believe how many emails and calls I get about people wanting to know, how did you do this? How can you do it? What are the different ways you can do it? And the issue, I think, is very interesting as a researcher and also sort of on a philosophical level. And the issue is this. When you go into an online place like Second Life, nowadays more than 80% of the people in Second Life are coming in from outside the U.S. So it's people from all over the world. And let's pretend that there's 20 people in this space right now and we're in Second Life and you're from Australia and this person's from Japan and this person's from Germany. And we're all sitting here and we're talking. Maybe we're making something together. Maybe we're having a church service and having a worship service. But we're having a kind of social interaction. Now, that social interaction does not depend on you flying to Japan to meet that person and that person in Japan flying to Germany to meet everyone in the physical world. That's not necessary. That social interaction that we're having there in Second Life doesn't require that we all meet each other in the physical world. Now, of course, if you die in China or Japan or your computer crashes, of course, that's going to have an effect. I don't mean that. But in terms of the social interaction that's happening in that place at that moment in Second Life, it doesn't require you go to meet all those people. Mm-hmm. So the idea behind this research project was I want to follow that reality, that I also don't have to fly to Japan and to China and to interview all these people. That would be almost a kind of disrespect towards the social interaction that's happening in Second Life. Now, of course, when I would talk to people, maybe I would learn a little bit about their lives in China or Japan. Maybe people are sharing that, but maybe they're not. That was something I was interested in learning more about myself, is as a kind of experiment, can you do this kind of research in the virtual world in its own terms and look at those social interactions of course, paying attention to the way that the physical world might be shaping this space, maybe ideas about buying and selling things, or, hey, there's green grass in Second Life. That must be coming from somewhere. Mm-hmm. But without having to go, you know, meet everyone in the physical world. And something I've tried to be very clear about is I'm not saying that has to be true for every research project, but that's one legitimate way to research these things. Now, let's say I had an idea for a research project of how do people who are disabled who can't walk in the physical world, they're in wheelchairs, how do they use Second Life and how does that ability sort of transform them? Now, if that was my research question, then it might make sense for me to actually go meet some of those people in the physical world and see how they're using their wheelchairs or talking about their bodies and then compare that with what's going on in Second Life. But where I've tried to draw the line and be very clear is I don't think that every research project has to do that. And in order to understand what's happening in these virtual world online spaces, we need to be able to do the research in world in some cases. And that was the experiment that I tried to do with this book. And what really shocked me, I was prepared for failure because failure is a great way to learn as a researcher, is when you fall flat on your face. I was really prepared for that. It was an experiment. And what just to this day shocked me, having done 15 years plus of research in Indonesia before this, was how little I had to change, was how easy it was, and how similar the problems or issues that came up doing research in Second Life were to Indonesia. It was really shocking. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour, Tom Belstorff, is a professor of anthropology at University of California, Irvine. He's here visiting the campus to talk about this very thing, this area of research of his. And again, I'll say if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for the book Coming of Age in Second Life, An Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human. It's published by Princeton and is out now in paper. And also, you can hear him this afternoon on the campus at 4. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As an anthropologist, you have done more traditional kind of fieldwork, at least the thing that you know you think of as the thing an anthropologist does. You've done fieldwork in Indonesia, so you went there and did that thing. And so you certainly have done that. I wonder, as you have talked about this kind of work, particularly early on, with other anthropologists, were they mostly with you and said, oh, yeah, that's very interesting? Or were there people who said, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Virtual world. You can't do that.
I've had both. For the most part, other anthropologists have been incredibly supportive, and my department was 100% supportive, and most people have been very supportive. But there have been – it's interesting to see cases where there have been certain kinds of – I don't know if rejection is the right word, but more of that kind of thing actually than even my research in Indonesia, which is on gay and lesbian Indonesians. It's not conventional by any measure. And part of the issue I think comes from the fact that these new technologies are very generational in the way that they're taken up. And especially, I'm senior enough now in my life, I can say, I think, that I've had senior colleagues or friends of mine who are my age or older who just don't have much experience with these technologies and who make it as a point of pride that they don't even know how to use PowerPoint, who just think that this is a waste of time, that it's just a bunch of elites, that it's just capitalism taking over people's lives, that it's, you know, ruining people's lives, this kind of immediate sort of dismissal of it. And, you know, anthropology originally began from a kind of emphasis on rural, countryside, islands far away, and that kind of mentality is still there in some corners of anthropology. But for, 75 years, that's been challenged. And so there's many anthropologists that have been very supportive and that have already been doing this kind of work. And, you know, there is a research community of anthropologists in this space doing this kind of research, many of them, before me, working not precisely on virtual worlds like Second Life necessarily, but on these questions of technology. So, what I try and tell those folks when I talk to them about these things is that the technology, in my experience and from my reading of the history of technology, is always neutral. I mean, you can run someone over with a car or drive them to the hospital. And, there was a lot of concern that TV would ruin people's minds and movies and radio and all of these technologies. And it's really what we do with them as human beings. And that's why I think it's important to understand them. And you could use virtual worlds for, stupid purposes or, as a waste of time. Or you could use it to teach a class or learn a new language or learn about another culture or, you're going through chemotherapy. therapy and you want to look like everyone else for a little while, or, you know, there's all kinds of ways that people can have sort of pen pals of people from other parts of the world, but they can meet in real time. And, you know, in world, there's a lot of families who use Second Life to stay in touch instead of calling on the phone, or use even online games like World of Warcraft for that purpose. A surprising number of families that play World of Warcraft together. So these technologies are, I think, really are neutral in that sense. And I don't want to rush to judge them as being negative, but I don't want to whitewash them. Of course, there can be negative effects of any of these things.
Yeah. We have a caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Uh-huh. I used Second Life back in 2007. There was a group of us who would meet at a place called EdTech Island for discussions. And what was interesting, we didn't really realize it until somebody told us we were doing it, but we were kind of adopting the same distance stance from each other as, you know, we might do in the real world. You know, we wouldn't stand too close to each other or stand too far away, you know, which seems kind of strange, why we would be doing that in a virtual environment. But I guess that's kind of my question. What kind of baggage do we bring in from the real world into Second Life? And what are some of the things you've found out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. With all new technologies, because they're new, we bring in what we know from beforehand. That's why when I look at your computer here, we call it a desktop, and there's a garbage can on it, and we talk about a file with folders, and we talk about a web page as if it's a page, because we always bring in ideas from what we already know into something new. I mean, people always do that. So that I think we can assume is something that will happen with any new technology. And then you're absolutely right. We see that with virtual worlds. That same kind of thing happens. So in Second Life, you can look like a 50-foot tall dragon or a little dot of light or a little toy dog or whatever you want. But most people, most of the time in Second Life, look roughly human and often look like very beautiful, you know, 20-something men and women. And in turn, there have been some studies on proxemics, like how close people stand to each other and things like that. And we're bringing in ideas from the physical world and making it real. And that's actually why even in Second Life, people will, when they're speaking quickly, talk about Second Life versus the real world. But in my book, I say it's all real. We don't want to imagine a real world that's not computer free. And so I talk about virtual worlds versus the actual world or the physical world, you know, whatever term it is you want to use. But we definitely are bringing these ideas in. And then what will happen over time is new cultural norms will emerge, and that will be interesting to track. So for instance, in Second Life, you can teleport, which you can't do in the physical world. Well, I could just disappear in front of you right now and reappear, you know, on the other side of Second Life, 100 virtual miles away, or quit the program and leave it altogether. And something I noticed during my research as an emerging virtual norm is that if you're sitting with a group of people in the house, it's considered impolite to just disappear and teleport. People would call it poofing. And a cultural norm emerged where you should stand up and walk out of the house and walk outside, and then you would teleport and disappear and sort of say goodbye. Now, that is not something that came from the physical world. That idea didn't really, you know, but it came from the cultural norms in Second Life, because if you just disappeared and teleported while you're sitting in a room with people, people might say, well, did the power go out in their neighborhood, or what happened to them? You know, are they okay? You know, did they crash? I mean, people would be sort of concerned. It would be considered sort of impolite. It's almost like sort of standing up and walking out of a conversation. So new cultural norms do emerge in these new technologies, these new spaces. That always happens. We've seen that with email and ideas around flaming, with all of those things. But the fact that you saw from your own experiences in Second Life that people are bringing metaphors and ideas and social norms from the physical world, that's not a surprise, because we see that with technology all the time. What then also becomes interesting to me is those ideas about like social distance are different in Sweden or Indonesia or Mexico. And when you have people from different parts of the world coming in, there's whole areas of Second Life that are Brazilian, Portuguese speaking. Brazilians love Second Life. How do those things change when you have different physical world cultures coming in and sort of mashing together is a really interesting area for further research and to think about. So that's an awesome question. It's a great question.
Yeah, I remember back in 2007, we were used to the thing crashing all the time, but usually we would just pop back in. I guess I'm wondering, I mean, I haven't really been on it since then, but I mean, what are the opportunities you think for distance learning and, you know, as opposed to just social interaction in Second Life? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
That's another great question. Educators originally were not a major presence in Second Life when I started my research, and then they came in big time. And there's a lot of universities now doing all kinds of experiments in Second Life. And it's, I think it's too early to tell for sure, you know, what will be possible and what will work. And it reminds me of the early days around ideas like educational TV or even using TVs for learning. And it's funny when I'll go to some of these classrooms in Second Life, I'm often invited to come speak, and I'll see this incredible virtual world, and what people will do is have a classroom with chairs and desks and a blackboard, and that's fine, but it's really not leveraging the creative possibilities that are possible. And I've seen some amazing educational experiments. If I have time in my talk later today on campus, I'll show people, for instance, the testes museum, I think it's called, to teach people about the human testes, where you actually, your avatar sits on a giant sperm and you fly through a human testes that are about 400 feet tall, and you get to fly inside and see all the ways that sperm is made and all this kind of stuff. And it's an amazing kind of biology exhibit that you, to make that physically in the physical world would just be prohibitively expensive. And it's really incredible to like fly through this thing and just see how it works, and you see the sperm flying around. So you have these kinds of creative possibilities that you can have probably with virtual worlds that we still just haven't even stumbled upon yet. But I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of interesting possibilities for distance learning in the in the future that we can't even imagine.
Yeah. Well, the caller get to the place that I was next thinking about going, and that is, it's not surprising that an anthropologist, someone who is interested in culture and how culture is made, would find something like Second Life interesting, because, as you say, if you have people from different cultures coming together in a sort of shared social space, bringing with them their cultural norms and their ideas, then you would wonder, well, what happens here? Is a new culture created? Are there cultural norms that exist in Second Life that don't exist anywhere else? Is it some sort of hybrid of what it is that people come from?
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating question that's still emergent. And that's actually one of the sort of conceptual links between this research that I'm doing in virtual worlds and my original research. People often ask, how the hell did you get from Indonesia to, you know, Second Life? That's a big change. And, you know, I wanted to try something new. But one of the sort of connections that I had is that in my research in Indonesia, I'm looking at these people halfway around the world who are mostly Muslim, who are calling themselves gay. And where did that term come from? It came from the West, but it gets Indonesianized. How is it getting transformed? What kind of new culture is happening when ideas move around the globe? And in some ways, that concept or that question is a question that I've carried into this research project as well, because Second Life, all these virtual worlds create, you know, their own cultural norms appear in them by the social interaction that happens inside of them. But then also people are bringing in all kinds, obviously, of cultural norms from all over the world. And what happens and all that stuff interacts is a really interesting question. And you know, something I mentioned in the book is that there often is a kind of founder effect, and Second Life is very U.S. and even California, Silicon Valley-centric in the way it was originally created. In fact, in the early days of the virtual world, when new land would be created, it would always be made to the West. It was like, go West, young man. But then things change when you get, you know, now there's areas in Second Life where people are trying to run things by Islamic law. There's Hare Krishnas in Second Life. There's Mormons in Second Life. There's all kinds of Japanese and Chinese areas in Second Life. And so what kind of – will you have sort of a bunch of separated, bubbled, multicultural things happening? And I think yes. And will you have common cultural norms emerge throughout? Probably in some sense. Will you have norms emerge between different virtual worlds? I think will happen as well, because very few people who do something like Second Life only do Second Life. They're often doing Facebook. They're doing email. They might be playing World of Warcraft or EVE Online, or, you know, doing other things as well. And so these different virtual worlds and technologies shape each other as well, because they aren't separated off from each other at a conceptual level. And so what kinds of new cultures are being formed is a really interesting question. And, you know, all I can say for sure is, yes, it's happening. Mm-hmm. But how is that going to be changing in the time to come, I think, is a really, really interesting question, because these things are so new still.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, Tom Belstorff, is an anthropologist at University of California, Irvine. This issue of virtual reality and how people people live in it is something that he's been interested in for now some time. He's written a book that explores this. It's titled Coming of Age in Second Life, An Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human. It is published by the Princeton University Press, is in paperback now. If you'd like to read the book, he is on the campus visiting. His visit here is sponsored by the Department of Anthropology, and he will be talking about these very things in a talk. This is a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. These programs are always free and open to the public, so if you'd like to hear more, you can stop by. Questions here are welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. In the work that you did, that you're still doing and that led to this book, you spent time in Second Life talking to people, trying to get to know them and to talk about who they are and why they're what they're doing and why they're doing this and so forth. You're trying to get at some of the motivation questions to maybe in part answer that big question, well, why do people do this? Because there's been a dramatic growth in virtual worlds. So that invites the question, well, you know, what are people getting out of this? And one of the commonplaces I think that often are tossed out there is, well, people participate in these things because essentially there's something wrong with them socially. That is, they can't relate to another person face to face, so they're using this technology to do that. How do you respond to that kind of characterization of people who do things like Second Life?
Yeah, well, once again, I think this is a common thing that happens around new technologies is people can't figure out why they would do it. They must have something wrong with them. And especially with virtual worlds, the best sort of popular cultural reference that most people have when they think about a virtual world still to this day is probably the Matrix movies. And that's not a very flattering view of virtual worlds. That's where a virtual world is used to enslave the human race. But, you know, and it's interesting to think about how just a few years ago, if you told someone that you were dating someone or got married to someone you met online, people would say you need to go see a psychiatrist. There's something seriously wrong with you. And I forget what the number is now. Is it 20 or 30% of all relationships now begin online? I mean, eHarmony and Match.com nowadays is just like the it's become the norm almost. It's no longer something that people think is so strange or weird. And you often have this kind of process that happens. And what's interesting with things like Second Life is, you know, sure, maybe there's some loners out there who use Second Life because for whatever reason, although then you'd still have to have social skills if you're going to do much. But what happens so often with these kinds of technologies is people just check it out on a whim and then they discover something they didn't even know they knew about they were interested in doing that they can then do through Second Life. So it's not that they had a pre-existing need or desire so much as they create a need or create an interest once they're inside Second Life. So even me personally as a researcher going into Second Life, in Second Life you can build in real time and you can build buildings and houses and do things like that. It's sort of like Legos you can walk in. And I've never gone to architecture school. I have no desire to do that. But I discovered this joy of building. I love building homes and like having people look at them and walk through them. And I just loved the problem of design and designing things. And I've never – it's not something that I desire strongly enough that I'm going to, you know, go to architecture school. But I really enjoy doing that in Second Life. And I personally, it's something I would do sort of on my off time when I wasn't doing interviews, whereas I kept tearing down my house and rebuilding it, trying out all kinds of new design ideas or, you know, I know people who will go into Second Life and discover they're really good at designing clothes for avatars. And maybe they never had the chance to go to design school or, you know, maybe they're a housewife in Minnesota, but they find out they're really good at designing clothes and they can even sell them. And in Second Life, you can sell stuff for money that you can actually earn dollars from what you sell. So there's people now who, you know, and maybe there are people who make $10,000 a month selling stuff in Second Life. It's the way they make their physical world income. There's people who do it and maybe just make $20 a month or whatever, but they – or even give stuff away for free, but they discover they have a knack for this and people, you know, like doing that. Or they go into Second Life and discover they make some friends and they can go to a club, you know, every Friday and hang out with their friends. And when I talk to people in Second Life about how do you make time for it, people who had spent a lot of time in Second Life, although most people in my researched, we didn't spend massive amounts of time in Second Life. By far, the most common response is, I just don't watch TV so much anymore. And when you compare TV to something like a virtual world, that's much more interactive, much more social, much less of a loner to be doing something on an online game or a virtual world than to be just sitting on the couch watching TV. It's way more interactive and demands much more from you in terms of hand-eye coordination as well as social skills. It's more social than watching TV. And that was by far the most common answer I heard. And if you look at the statistics on the average number of hours that Americans watch TV every week, you know, you could easily cut 4 or 5 hours out of that for spending time in a virtual world and still have plenty of time for your family and friends and job and whatever. So, you know, there are cases of people for whom virtual worlds or online games start getting in the way of their work or home life. It sort of overtakes their life. But just like with anything else, I don't think that's the norm from what I was able to see. It can happen. With anything can be used in a way that's not helpful to people. But I don't think there's anything inevitable in the technology that makes that so.
Well, I think going back to the previous conversation we had, I think at some point You made the point that there would have been a time when there were people who had long, elaborate courtships and had long relationships that were conducted by mail.
Oh, yeah.
And we wouldn't really think that was so odd now. And certainly people at that time didn't think that that was odd. That was the technology that was available, and people used it.
Yeah, after the invention of the postage stamp in the 19th century, you had this whole Victorian love letter culture arise. People would spend hours and hours writing letters and waiting for the next letter to arrive and all that kind of thing. So the use of technology to mediate these kinds of connections, I mean, there were people getting married over the telegraph, you know, in the late 19th century. So not all of this is new. Pieces of it are new for sure, but not all of it is new. And it can be used for good or ill. And I think one reason why I care about doing the research is I want to think about ways that we can have it be something that's helpful to people.
This – talking about this certainly gets you to questions about what is real and what is not. And I'm sure that one of the basic questions it has to do with, to what extent is – this world that we're talking about, to what extent is Second Life real, and to what extent are the bodies that exist, the virtual bodies that people inhabit when they are living in Second Life, to what extent are those real?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that's actually the talk I'm doing today is more sort of a philosophical talk, thinking about some of those issues, because that's a great thing we can learn from these things, is it makes us sit back and think what counts as real. You know, if in the 19th century I was sending love letters to someone who lived in another country or a long way away over years and years, for over 5 years, and maybe I never met that person. Maybe they died before I ever got to meet them. But I was madly in love with them and they were in love with me. Was that love real, even though we never met face to face? I mean, most people would say yes. I mean, there's migrant families now where a mother will leave her family and go to work in the United States, Europe, or some other country, and a child will be born. You know, she leaves when the child is very young, or father who leaves before the child is even born, and they might work in that other country and maybe not see the kid until the kid is 5 or 6 years old. But all along, they're trying to stay in touch, and they love that kid. Is that love real? You know, what counts as real is a really interesting, debatable question. And one thing I try and think about in the book as well is that the idea of being virtual didn't start with these virtual worlds. And there's aspects of human life that have always been, you know, virtual. I mean, we have all kinds of social norms, like you shouldn't stand up or walk out of a room or whatever, but I can't touch that idea. You know, that's an idea. You can't touch an idea. You can't touch language, but we're using language right now to talk. Is that real? You know, it's neurons and mouths and air, but it's also a grammar that is not something that I can touch. It's virtual in a certain sense. And so I think it really does help us think about the question of what counts as real. And you know, this extends far beyond virtual worlds. You know, if I buy some music off of iTunes, is that real? I'm not supposed to copy it illegally, you know, but is it real or not? It's not a cassette or a record I can pick up with my hand or even a CD. It's just moved from one computer to another. It's just a file. It's virtual, just as virtual as a shirt on an avatar in Second Life. But if I try and share that illegally, mm-hmm. you better believe that Apple thinks it's real, or the artist thinks that that is real and that I shouldn't be copying illegally, and they will have their lawyers let me know that if at all possible. So what counts as real, you know, stealing Windows software or whatever, what counts as real, I think, is a really interesting question to think about. And I think that question isn't really unique to virtual worlds. It's more that virtual worlds sort of really bring that into focus and let us really think about that question of what counts as real, where, you know, through Facebook, I friend an old high school friend that I haven't seen in 15 years and we hit it off again. Is our friendship real? You know, or I friend someone on Facebook that I've never met and I never will meet. I have friends on Facebook I've never met. They're a friend of a friend in Indonesia or something. Is that friendship real? What counts as real? I think it's a fascinating, fascinating question.
And does this also get you to some questions about virtual identities and also to what extent that's something that also people have always done? They have tried on or they have made or had they have tried on identities, and that this is maybe a more sophisticated tool that would allow you to do that in ways that we couldn't do it before. But also, that's not something new. People have been doing that for a long time.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and so once again, to be clear, virtual worlds are often used for role-playing, and Second Life is, but they don't have to be, because when the IBM Corporation has a business meeting in Second Life, that's not role-playing. Yeah. Or when a university teaches a class in Second Life, that's not role-playing, although maybe it should be more often. It might give you some interesting new possibilities. But certainly one use of these technologies can be for role-playing, and that includes the virtual worlds that are structured like games. So World of Warcraft, EverQuest, Lord of the Rings Online, I mean, those are very heavily structured around ideas of role-playing, and you can do that in Second Life as well. But, you know, so far as we know from anthropology and history, people have been acting or playing roles or pretending since the dawn of human history. I mean, since cave paintings, people have pretended to be someone else and imagine what that might like to be. And kids have pretended to be cops and robbers or whatever it is that they do as long as we know. So the idea of an imagination and the life of the imagination and pretending to be something different than what you are is certainly not new to virtual worlds. And it's fun to see now when in Second Life people will perform Shakespeare plays or will do a sort of play inside of Second Life, which I think is a fascinating kind of double turn on this idea of role-playing. So there'll be an avatar pretending to be Hamlet, right? So there's a kind of double role-playing that's happening in that case. And so, you know, once again, to be clear, that's not the only way that virtual worlds can be used, but that certainly is a big way that they get used. And that desire to see what it's like to be someone else did not begin with virtual worlds, for sure. That's been around as long as there have been people, and seems to be something that happens in all cultures worldwide.
Yeah, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Tom Belstorff is our guest. He's an anthropologist at University of California, Irvine. He is the author of the book Coming of Age in Second Life, which is now out in paper from Princeton University Press. He's here to give a talk about these things on the campus. That's later this afternoon. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you have said, I think when we talked before, that maybe the big questions here that you're interested in as an anthropologist is, well, what by studying them the way you have, what can we learn about virtual worlds, but also what can virtual worlds teach us about the real world? Do you have particularly, I guess, to the second question, do you think that you have learned some things that are interesting and important
in terms of what they can teach us about the physical world?
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, they've taught me a lot of things in terms of thinking about the ways that our physical world lives have virtual aspects to them. And as an anthropologist, it has helped me think about sort of the project of anthropology, because in a way, anthropology, as I say in the book from the beginning, has always been a kind of virtual thing where it's like turning yourself into an avatar and imagining what it would be like to grow up in Bali or to grow up in Peru or to be in a different culture, to be in someone else's shoes, right? It's been something that anthropologists have been interested in for a long time. And so virtual worlds have helped me sort of think about that in a new way. And virtual worlds, I think, also have been very interesting for helping people think about the role of the body and physicality in culture. Since the talk I'm giving today is focusing around ideas of the body, and you know, just as to give a example of something that's very specific, but we always try as researchers to research narrowly and think broadly. There are people in the physical world, obviously, who think they might be that they should be the other gender, that they might be transgender, that they might want to have a sex change operation and change their gender. And there are some really interesting examples of these kinds of folks going into Second Life and becoming the avatar of the other gender. So maybe they're born a man and they go into Second Life and they have a female avatar and they sort of want to try it out. And it can often be this amazing aha moment for them where they realize, wow, I really feel more like myself when I'm this other gender. And they actually feel that that avatar is almost more their real body than their physical body feels more virtual in a sense. And that could be a real sign for them that maybe that they really are transgender. And there are actually support groups for this. And there have also been some interesting narratives from people who will go into Second Life and change their gender or change their race. And, you know, once again, just to make up an example based on my research of, you know, a man who goes into Second Life and has a female avatar, just tries it for a day, or being, if they're white, being African-American or Latino. And talking about what an incredible eye-opener it is that you would think in a virtual world that you wouldn't have racism or sexism, but that they become a female avatar and they just can't believe the way that people treat them in some cases, and that they really feel, wow, that they have really learned something about what it's like to be different than who they are sort of in the physical world. So you can pick up sort of little examples here and there of ways that it teaches us things. And on the broad level, I think to help us think about ways that human life has always been virtual. But then also a third thing is these technologies are here to stay. And it used to be that we spent 0% of our lives in virtual worlds. And it's never going to become 100%. Our lives are not going to become the Matrix. But these are here to stay in all of their forms. Facebook is here to stay. You know, all these technologies are here to stay, even if it's some other company and not Facebook. And so I think we need to understand how these things work and how they shape our physical world lives and how they shape our lives in the broadest sense, physical and virtual, is a really important area for us to keep learning about.
Let's talk with Connor in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Very interesting conversation. I just tuned in like 10 minutes ago, so I'm not sure if this has already been covered, but you've been talking about the individual going into virtual worlds and their the influence that it has on them and the relationship to the physical world. I thought about more of a social context in terms of – or a political context. For example, the Bush administration in 2003 went to war in Iraq because of faulty intelligence and so forth. And there have been articles written about that say that they were sort of in a bubble and they created their own virtual reality and, you know, got things completely wrong in the war. And one could almost think that would be sort of a form of virtual reality, but it's in the political context, which affects other people's lives, versus just, you know, the individual context where you're in Second Life and it's really your own life. So have you studied that kind of thing?
Sure. That's a great question. As an anthropologist, I'm really interested in culture and the social as well, so as well as the individual. So that's absolutely a great question. And so there's a broad way in which you can use virtual to talk about imagination or all kinds of things. And then there's the specific example of virtual worlds. But virtual worlds can be political spaces, and that's going to be a very interesting area to be watching in the future, just like with the internet more broadly. So a colleague of mine at the University of Southern California helped create a virtual Guantanamo Bay where people could experience what Guantanamo Bay is like in a certain sense. And there have been very interesting uses of virtual worlds for political organizing and around all kinds of issues, from environmentalism, the World Wildlife Fund, things like that, to all kinds of political groups, seeing what might be possible with virtual worlds for organizing that maybe would be different from using a web page or email or that kind of thing. And when you think about how late the politicians were to come even to basic things like blogs, I mean, it was Howard Dean, and it wasn't that long ago before they even realized, oh, wow, there's this internet thing. Maybe we should be using it. And now it's become a major tool for fundraising and for getting the word word out and people, you know, using Facebook and Twitter, politicians doing that kind of thing. But they were sort of late to the game. It took them a while to realize, oh, wow, we could use this for political purposes. And so I think with virtual worlds, there's a similar kind of lag where, you know, during the recent presidential election, Obama and Hillary Clinton and a whole bunch of other politicians actually had events or a presence in Second Life and other virtual worlds. But it's still very experimental. And so far, there haven't been major uses of these spaces for these kinds of political things. There has been a virtual U.S. Congress in Second Life and other kinds of things. But I think this is an area to watch, because if history is any guide, eventually we're going to see interesting, creative new uses of these spaces for political awareness or organizing or all kinds of things. I can't imagine that not happening. How big will it get, or what form will it take? It's really hard to predict the future, but I'm sure that something is going to continue to happen with those uses of virtual worlds for all kinds of political organizing and nonprofit organizing as well.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I guess what I am concerned about is an asymmetry in the level of power. For example, an administration that's actually in power and has the power of the government or corporations actually behind them may be able to manipulate public opinion by preventing access via non-net neutrality, for example, and prevent people politically organizing virtually. And, you know, this is sort of an adversarial look at things, but That is a concern of mine, and it will be interesting to see how that sort of thing unfolds.
Well, absolutely. There's two pieces to that. That's a very important issue and very important thing to watch. And there's two quick things I can mention of that. One is around governmental control and attempts to control virtual world spaces. And just like the internet was originally created by the military has been in Second Life and in these virtual worlds from the beginning. And their military uses of these for combat training and simulation have been going on from the very beginning. And we need to be aware of that and think about that. But then a related issue you touched on there is that there's no reason why you can't have virtual worlds that are open source, controlled by a bunch of people for free, or that are run by nonprofits. And there are some small examples of that. But most virtual worlds are run by corporations, for-profit corporations, including Second Life, including the ones for kids. You know, Disney is the owner now of Club Penguin, for instance. But they are run by for-profit corporations, and they have incredible power in these virtual worlds. The most powerful dictator in the United States or any country, you know, wherever, George Bush or General Suharto, the former dictator in Indonesia, they could do a lot of stuff, but George Bush couldn't say, you know what, I want gravity to go up instead of down now. You know, I think I'd like the sky to be red instead of green. But in Second Life, they literally could do that.
Oh, yeah.
And people, of course, could decide to leave and say, well, you know, I don't want to participate anymore. But these companies that own these virtual worlds, in my book and elsewhere, other people have written about this, have very interesting conflicts and debates they get into with the people who participate in them over questions of governance and control. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the possible uses of these things for organizing and that kind of thing, there is great potential, but there is also great peril. And I think you're absolutely right that we really want to keep our eyes open around the broader issue of net neutrality, but also the specific issue of both government and corporate influence in all of these virtual world online spaces. And that includes social networking sites like Facebook. This is by no means an issue only for virtual worlds. You're absolutely right. This is about internet technologies in the broadest sense, but certainly including virtual worlds as well.
Thank you. That was very interesting. Mm-hmm. One last comment. Facebook is actually larger than the United States, I heard in The Economist.
Oh, absolutely.
Wrong. So that's an interesting phenomenon. It will be interesting to see it unfold. Thank you so much.
Thank
you. You're very welcome.
We're coming down here. We have a couple minutes left. Something that I'd like to talk at least a little bit about, and I know that your interest in virtual worlds got you thinking about cloud computing. And this, I think, also raises some really interesting questions about people's willingness to believe in, to be comfortable with the idea that something that they use, something that they're maybe personally connected to and that they think is very important, exists even though they can't hold it. That, in some ways, when you think about that, that's a pretty radical kind of notion. And then you ask this question, well, how far do you go with that?
Yeah. Well, just so we're all clear, what cloud computing usually means is where data is not stored on your computer on the hard drive, but somewhere on a computer or a server, as it's called, somewhere in some county, somewhere in a warehouse, and you access it online. That's what cloud computing means. And virtual worlds couldn't work without cloud computing, because the whole point of a virtual world like Second Life or World of Warcraft is I have it on my computer and I make my house. If I shut down my computer, my house doesn't disappear. It stays there in Second Life or World of Warcraft. Why? Because it's in the cloud. It's on a server somewhere, so you could log in from another state and you would see my house there even though my computer is turned off. So you can have a single-player computer game on a computer that looks beautiful. It can look just like Second Life, but I shut down my computer, it's gone. That's not a virtual world. So virtual worlds require cloud computing. They can't work without it. But cloud computing now is spreading to other things like email, where instead of having your email on your computer, you use something like Gmail. It's all being stored on a computer somewhere else. It's in the cloud. And one big push that a lot of technology companies are making is that more and more your device that you have, an iPad, an iPhone, a laptop, whatever, will have almost no data on it anymore. That allows it to be small, have good battery life, and that almost everything will be on the cloud. Not only a big initiative that Google is doing, not only your data, but actually the programs. So instead of, for instance, downloading Microsoft Word or some program, your computer accesses not just the data, but actually the application as well, right? Gmail is another example of that. Is all being done through the cloud. And so, like with any technological innovation, this has exciting possibilities and it has a lot of dangers, because actually it's an interesting kind of return of what we used to call mainframe computing before the invention of the personal computer, when everything was held in some big room. And there are real issues around there of control and privacy and access when all of Second Life and all of your email and all of your everything is on some server in North Carolina or who knows where it is, and the company could read it, could do anything they want to, whereas if it's on your hard drive, in theory, you have a little more control over it if it's only on your computer. So there's some really wonderful possibilities that the cloud computing idea carries with it, but there's also a lot of dangers, and it is definitely a re-centralization of computing. Computing originally was very centralized. Computers were really big and really expensive. With the personal computer, it really got distributed, and the internet was part of that distribution. And cloud computing is a re-centralization of computer, of everything about computers. And that has a lot of interesting potential, but I think we need to definitely have more conversations about the dangers of that centralization, because then who has control, who has access, how do we protect intellectual property, privacy, all those kinds of things become new issues.
Yeah. Well, a lot of really interesting questions. We could talk more, but we can't because we're here at the end of the time. But for folks who are here in Champaign and Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from Tom Belstorff, he's an anthropologist at University of California, Irvine. He's speaking this afternoon on the subject, Placing the Virtual Body. This is a MillerCom event. It's sponsored by the Department of Anthropology. This afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory in Urbana. And if you can't make the talk, but you'd like to read more about the subject, you can look for his book, Coming of Age in Second Life, an Anthropologist Explores the Virtually Human. Princeton is the publisher, and it's out now in paperback. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.